certain that Karelin would neatly frustrate them. But the supervisor had done nothing. Absolutely nothing. This was not quite as reassuring as might have been expected. Karelin had plenty of time. He might be preparing a delayed counterstroke. Or he might be so certain of the project's failure that he felt no need to take any action against it. That the colony would fail had been the prediction of most people. Yet even in the past, long before any real knowledge of social dynamics had existed, there had been many communities devoted to special religious or philosophical ends. It was true that their mortality rate had been high, but some had survived. And the foundations of New Athens were as secure as modern science could make them. There were many reasons for choosing an island site. Not the least important were psychological. In an age of universal air transport, the ocean meant nothing as a physical barrier, but it still gave a sense of isolation. Moreover, a limited land area made it impossible for too many people to live in the colony. The maximum population was fixed at 100,000. More than that, and the advantages inherent in a small, compact community would be lost. One of the aims of the founders was that any member of New Athens should know all the citizens who shared his interests, and as many as 1 or 2% of the remainder as well. The man who had been the driving force behind New Athens was a Jew, and, like Moses, he had never lived to enter his promised land, for the colony had been founded 3 years after his death. He had been born in Israel, the last independent nation ever to come into existence, and, therefore, the shortest lived. The end of national sovereignty had been felt here perhaps more bitterly than anywhere else, for it is hard to lose a dream which one has just achieved after centuries of striving. Ben Solomon was no fanatic, but the memories of his childhood must have determined, to no small extent, the philosophy he was to put into practice. He could just remember what the world had been before the advent of the overlords, and had no wish to return to it. Like not a few other intelligent and well-meaning men, he could appreciate all that Karelin had done for the human race while still being unhappy about the supervisor's ultimate plans. Was it possible, he sometimes said to himself, that despite all their enormous intelligence, the overlords did not really understand mankind, and were making a terrible mistake from the best of motives? Suppose, in their altruistic passion for justice and order, they had determined to reform the world, but had not realized that they were destroying the soul of man. The decline had barely started, yet the first symptoms of decay were not hard to discover. Solomon was no artist, but he had an acute appreciation of art, and knew that his age could not match the achievements of previous centuries in any single field. Perhaps matters would right themselves in due course, when the shock of encountering the overlord civilization had worn off. But it might not, and a prudent man would consider taking out an insurance policy. New Athens was that policy. Its establishment had taken 20 years and some billions of pounds decimal, a relatively trivial fraction, therefore, of the world's total wealth. Nothing had happened for the first 15 years. Everything had happened in the last 5. Solomon's task would have been impossible had he not been able to convince a handful of the world's most famous artists that his plan was sound. They had sympathized because it appealed to their egos, not because it was important for the race. But, once convinced, the world had listened to them and given both moral and material support. Behind this spectacular facade of temperamental talent, the real architects of the colony had laid their plans. A society consists of human beings whose behavior as individuals is unpredictable. But if one takes enough of the basic units, then certain laws begin to appear, as was discovered long ago by life insurance companies. No one can tell what individuals will die in a given time, yet the total number of deaths can be predicted with considerable accuracy. There are other, subtler laws, first glimpsed in the early 20th century by mathematicians such as Wiener and Rashevsky. They had argued that such events as economic depressions, the results of armament races, the stability of social groups, political elections, and so on, could be analyzed by the correct mathematical techniques. The great difficulty was the enormous number of variables, many of them hard to define in numerical terms. One could not draw a set of curves and state definitely, when this line is reached, it will mean war. And one could never wholly allow for such utterly unpredictable events as the assassination of a key figure or the effects of some new scientific discovery. Still less such natural catastrophes as earthquakes or floods, which might have a profound effect on large numbers of people and the social groups in which they lived. Yet one could do much, thanks to the knowledge patiently accumulated during the past 100 years. The task would have been impossible without the aid of the giant computing machines that could perform the work of 1,000 human calculators in a matter of seconds. Such aids had been used to the utmost when the colony was planned. Even so, the founders of New Athens could only provide the soil and the climate in which the plant they wished to cherish might, or might not, come to flower. As Solomon himself had remarked, "We can be sure of talent. We can only pray for genius." But it was a reasonable hope that in such a concentrated society some interesting reactions would take place. Few artists thrive in solitude, and nothing is more stimulating than the conflict of minds with similar interests. So far, the conflict had produced worthwhile results in sculpture, music, literary criticism, and filmmaking. It was still too early to see if the group working on historical research would fulfill the hopes of its instigators, who were frankly aiming at restoring mankind's pride in its own achievements. Painting still languished, which supported the view of those who considered that static, two-dimensional forms of art had no further possibilities. It was noticeable, though a satisfactory explanation for this had not yet been produced, that time played an essential part in the colony's most successful artistic achievements. Even its sculpture was seldom immobile. Andrew Carson's intriguing volumes and curves changed slowly as one watched, according to complex patterns that the mind could appreciate, even if it could not fully comprehend them. Indeed, Carson claimed with some truth to have taken the mobiles of a century before to their ultimate conclusion, and thus to have wedded sculpture and ballet. Much of the colony's musical experimenting was, quite consciously, concerned with what might be called time span. What was the briefest note that the mind could grasp, or the longest that it could tolerate without boredom? Could the result be varied by conditioning or by the use of appropriate orchestration? Such problems were discussed endlessly, and the arguments were not purely academic. They had resulted in some extremely interesting compositions. But it was in the art of the cartoon film, with its limitless possibilities, that New Athens had made its most successful experiments. The 100 years since the time of Disney had still left much undone in this most flexible of all mediums. On the purely realistic side, results could be produced indistinguishable from actual photography, much to the contempt of those who were developing the cartoon along abstract lines. The group of artists and scientists that had so far done least was the one that had attracted the greatest interest and the greatest alarm. This was the team working on total identification. The history of the cinema gave the clue to their actions. First, sound, then color, then stereoscopy, then cinerama had made the old moving pictures more and more like reality itself. Where was the end of the story? Surely the final stage would be reached when the audience forgot it was an audience and became part of the action. To achieve this would involve stimulation of all the senses, and perhaps hypnosis as well. But many believed it to be practical. When the goal was attained, there would be an enormous enrichment of human experience. A man could become, for a while at least, any other person, and could take part in any conceivable adventure, real or imaginary. He could even be a plant or an animal if it proved possible to capture and record the sense impressions of other living creatures. And when the program was over, he would have acquired a memory as vivid as any experience in his actual life, indeed indistinguishable from reality itself. The prospect was dazzling. Many also found it terrifying and hoped that the enterprise would fail. But they knew in their hearts that once science had declared a thing possible, there was no escape from its eventual realization. This, then, was New Athens and some of its dreams. It hoped to become what the old Athens might have been had it possessed machines instead of slaves, science instead of superstition. But it was much too early yet to tell if the experiment would succeed. Chapter 16. Jeffrey Gregson was one islander who, as yet, had no interest in aesthetics or science, the two main preoccupations of his elders. But he heartily approved of the colony, for purely personal reasons. The sea, never more than a few kilometers away in any direction, fascinated him. Most of his short life had been spent far inland, and he was not yet accustomed to the novelty of being surrounded by water. He was a good swimmer, and would often cycle off with other young friends, carrying his fins and mask, to go exploring the shallower water of the lagoon. At first, Jean was not very happy about this, but after she had made a few dives herself, she lost her fear of the sea and its strange creatures and let Jeffrey enjoy himself as he pleased, on condition that he never swam alone. The other member of the Gregson household who approved of the change was Fay, the beautiful golden retriever who nominally belonged to George but could seldom be detached from Jeffrey. The two were inseparable, both by day and, if Jean had not put her foot down, by night. Only when Jeffrey went off on his bicycle did Fay remain at home, lying listlessly in front of the door and staring down the road with moist, mournful eyes, her muzzle resting on her paws. This was rather mortifying to George, who had paid a stiff price for Fay and her pedigree. It looked as if he would have to wait for the next generation, due in 3 months, before he could have a dog of his own. Jean had other views on the subject. She liked Fay, but felt that one hound per house was quite sufficient. Only Jennifer Ann had not yet decided whether she liked the colony. That, however, was hardly surprising, for she had so far seen nothing of the world beyond the plastic panels of her cot, and had, as yet, very little suspicion that such a place existed. George Gregson did not often think about the past. He was too busy with plans for the future, too much occupied by his work and his children. It was seldom, indeed, that his mind went back across the years to that evening in Africa, and he never talked about it with Jean. By mutual consent, the subject was avoided, and since that day they had never visited the Boyces again, despite repeated invitations. They called Rupert with fresh excuses several times a year, and lately he had ceased to bother them. His marriage to Maya, rather to everyone's surprise, still seemed to be flourishing. One result of that evening was that Jean had lost all desire to dabble with mysteries at the borders of known science. The naive and uncritical wonder that had drawn her to Rupert and his experiments had completely vanished. Perhaps she had been convinced and wanted no more proof. George preferred not to ask her. Possibly the cares of maternity had banished such interests from her mind. There was no point, George knew, in worrying about a mystery that could never be solved. Yet sometimes, in the stillness of the night, he would wake and wonder. He remembered his meeting with Jan Roderick's on the roof of Rupert's house, and the few words that were all he had spoken with the only human being successfully to defy the Overlord's ban. Nothing in the realm of the supernatural, thought George, could be more eerie than the plain scientific fact that though almost 10 years had passed since he had spoken to Jan, that now far distant voyager would have aged by only a few days. The universe was vast, but that fact terrified him less than its mystery. George was not a person who thought deeply on such matters, yet sometimes it seemed to him that men were like children amusing themselves in some secluded playground, protected from the fierce realities of the outer world. Jan Roderick's had resented that protection and had escaped from it, into no one knew what. But in this matter, George found himself on the side of the overlords. He had no wish to face whatever lurked in the unknown darkness, just beyond the little circle of light cast by the lamp of science. "How is it," said George plaintively, "that Jeff's always off somewhere when I happen to be home? Where's he gone today?" Jean looked up from her knitting, an archaic occupation which had recently been revived with much success. Such fashions came and went on the island with some rapidity. The main result of this particular craze was that the men had now all been presented with multicolored sweaters, far too hot to wear in the daytime, but quite useful after sundown. "He's gone off to Sparta with some friends," Jean replied. "He promised to be back for dinner." "I really came home to do some work," said George thoughtfully. "But it's a nice day, and I think I'll go out there and have a swim myself. What kind of fish would you like me to bring back?" George had never caught anything, and the fish in the lagoon were much too wily to be trapped. Jean was just going to point this out when the stillness of the afternoon was shattered by a sound that still had power, even in this peaceful age, to chill the blood and set the scalp crawling with apprehension. It was the wail of a siren, rising and falling, spreading its message of danger in concentric circles out to sea. For almost 100 years, the stresses had been slowly increasing, here in the burning darkness deep beneath the ocean's floor. Though the submarine canyon had been formed geological ages ago, the tortured rocks had never reconciled themselves to their new positions. Countless times the strata had creaked and shifted as the unimaginable weight of water disturbed their precarious equilibrium. They were ready to move again. Jeff was exploring the rock pools along the narrow Spartan beach, an occupation he found endlessly absorbing. One never knew what exotic creatures one might find sheltered here from the waves that marched forever across the Pacific to spend themselves against the reef. It was a fairyland for any child, and at the moment he possessed it all himself, for his friends had gone up into the hills. The day was quiet and peaceful. There was not a breath of wind, and even the perpetual muttering beyond the reef had sunk to a sullen undertone. A blazing sun hung halfway down the sky, but Jeff's mahogany-brown body was now quite immune to its onslaughts. The beach here was a narrow belt of sand, sloping steeply towards the lagoon. Looking down into the glass-clear water, Jeff could see the submerged rocks, which were as familiar to him as any formations on the land. About 10 meters down, the weed-covered ribs of an ancient schooner curved up towards the world it had left almost 2 centuries ago. Jeff and his friends had often explored the wreck, but their hopes of hidden treasure had been disappointed. All that they had ever retrieved was a barnacle-encrusted compass. Very firmly, something took hold of the beach and gave it a single, sudden jerk. The tremor passed so swiftly that Jeff wondered if he had imagined it. Perhaps it was a momentary giddiness, for all around him remained utterly unchanged. The waters of the lagoon were unruffled, the sky empty of cloud or menace. And then a very strange thing began to happen. Swifter than any tide could ebb, the water was receding from the shore. Jeff watched, deeply puzzled and not in the least afraid, as the wet sands were uncovered and lay sparkling in the sun. He followed the retreating ocean, determined to make the most of whatever miracle had opened up the underwater